Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we kind of move forward in educating you, we're just going to keep on making the argument. We got to continue to learn, pray, and act as we appeal to heaven. Also want to impress upon you that the center of the movement, if we're going to save the Constitution, save our liberties, if we're not going to fall into the arms of the globalists, we must demand compliance to the rule of law, to the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. It's that simple, folks. Don't let anybody continue to divide you on the stupid, divisive issues that they want to bring forward. You want to just start, you put an end to it? Full compliance to the Constitution. It's that simple. And as we look at the upcoming 2028 election, if you'd like to have the dialogue, maybe what I'll do is try to create down the road, once we're done with all the content, maybe down the road we'll actually start a forum for those people who really want to talk about the Electoral College. Because once people start getting educated, really what the Electoral College is and what it should be and how it's supposed to work, then I think people will start seeing how our whole country has been completely manipulated by the party since 1856. Anyway, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And with that, I think we kind of left off last week, where we were diving into Reverend Stillman's comments, and he just started talking about the petition and the militia campaign. And so what we want to do is kind of cover that. And I think that there will probably be a little bit, I know this is a long oration, but there's a few more things that we will want to cover in this, which are the recommended and then my analysis and so forth. So what we'll end up doing today is we'll be wrapping up the Massachusetts ratification debates. And then what we'll do is we will go into South Carolina. So probably after our break, we will, you know, go into the South Carolina debates. Okay?
Okay.
Because I think that's how it'll play out today. I think we'll actually wrap up on Massachusetts today. So let's go ahead and go into this, you know, the petition and the campaign. Go ahead, take it from there.
Okay. So this is the second paragraph.
Every
2 years there will be a revolution in the general government in favor of the people. At the expiration of the first 2 years, there will be a new choice of representatives. At the expiration of the second 2 years, there will be a new choice of president and representatives. And at the expiration of the third term, making 6 years from the commencement of the Congress, there will be a new choice of senators and representatives. We all know, sir, that power, thus frequently reverting to the people, will prove a security to their liberties and a most important check to the power of the general government.
Yes.
Fourth, Congress can make no laws. Do you want to stop there?
No. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Fourth, Congress can make no laws that will oppress the people, which will not equally involve themselves in the oppression.
So that's the third time. That's the third time that they brought that up, that Congress cannot immune themselves from the laws that they create.
What possible motive then can Congress have to abuse their power? Can any man suppose that they will be so lost to their own interest as to abuse their power, knowing at the same time that they equally involve themselves in the difficulty? It is a most improbable supposition. Thus, this would be like a man cutting off his nose to spite his face. I place this, sir, among the securities of the liberties of my fellow citizens and rejoice in it. Fifth, Congress guarantee to every state in the Union a republic form of government and engage to protect them against all foreign and domestic enemies, that is, and as hath been justly observed by the honorable gentleman Mr. Adams near me, of known and tried abilities as a politician, each state shall choose such republican form of government as they please, and Congress solemnly engage themselves to protect it from every kind of violence, whether a faction at home or enemies abroad. This is an admirable security of the people at large, as well as of the several governments of the states. Consequently, the general government cannot swallow up the local governments, as some gentlemen have suggested.
So if you stop, if I get you to stop right there, going back up, Mr. Adams basically made this comment that each state shall choose such republican form of government as they please, and Congress solemnly engage themselves to protect it. So does it mean that Congress can actually define how your republican government is going to be formed in any way?
No.
Again, this kind of, in a side-oblique way, brings up this concept of new states coming into the Union, that they will have their own self-destiny, they'll be able to choose for themselves what to do and so forth, and that Congress will protect that government. As I'm highlighting that red, we don't have that red, and it is now red. Go ahead.
This is an admirable security of the people at large, as well as of the several governments of the states. Consequently, the general government cannot swallow up the local governments, as some gentlemen have suggested. Their existence is dependent on each other and must stand or fall together. Should Congress ever attempt the destruction of the particular legislatures, they would be in the same predicament with Samson, who overthrew the house in which the Philistines were making sport at his expense. Them he killed, indeed, but he buried himself in the ruins.
Okay.
Sixth, another check in favor of the people is this, that the Constitution provides for the impeachment, trial, and punishment of every officer in Congress who shall be guilty of malconduct.
Okay.
With such a prospect, go ahead.
Okay, so the impeachment process of every officer in Congress has now been superseded by the 14th Amendment of Section 3. Because the standard changed. Because there were too few people that were actually supporting the Constitution, or enough of them actually turned their back and violated the Constitution, that Section 3 was amended, or the 14th Amendment was amended into the Constitution, giving us Section 3, that if a person fails to support the Constitution in any way, they can and will be removed immediately. That's the law. So go ahead.
Okay. Where was I at? Let's see. Another check in favor of the people is that the Constitution provides for the impeachment, trial, and punishment of every officer in Congress who shall be guilty of malconduct with such a prospect who will dare to abuse the powers vested in him by the people. Seventh, having thus considered several of the checks to the powers of Congress, which are interwoven with the Constitution, we will now suppose the worst that can take place in consequence of its adoption, I mean that it shall be found in some of its parts oppressive to the people. Still, we have this dernier resort. It may be amended. It is not, like the laws of the Medes and Persians, immutable. The fifth article provides for amendments. It has been said it will be difficult after its ratification to procure any alterations. By no means, sir. For this weighty reason, it is a general government, and as such will have a general influence. All states in the Union will feel the difficulty, and feeling it, will readily concur in adopting the method provided by the Constitution. And having once made the trial, experience will teach us what amendments are necessary. Viewing the Constitution in this light, I stand ready to give my vote for it without any amendments at all. Yet if the amendments proposed by Your Excellency will tend to conciliation, I readily admit them, not as a condition of acceptance, but as a matter of recommendation only, knowing that blessed are the peacemakers. I am ready, sir, to submit my life, my liberty, my family, my property, and as far as my vote will go, the interests of my constituents to this general government. After all, if this Constitution was as perfect as the sacred volume is, It would not secure the liberties of the people unless they watch their own liberties. Nothing written on paper will do this. It is therefore necessary that the people should keep a watchful, not an overjealous, eye on their rulers, and that they should give all due encouragement to our colleges, schools of learning, etc., so that knowledge may be diffused through every part of our country. Ignorance and slavery, knowledge and freedom, are inseparably connected. While Americans remain in their present enlightened condition and warmly attached to the cause of liberty, they cannot be enslaved. Should the general government become so lost to all sense of honor and the freedom of the people as to attempt to enslave them, they who are the descendants of a race of men who have dethroned kings would make an American Congress tremble, strip them of their public honors, and reduce them to the lowest state of degradation.
So there you go. So what do you think of that final statement? And what do you think about actually that part in red already? After all, if this Constitution was as perfect as the sacred volume is, the Bible, it would not secure the liberties of the people unless they watch their own liberties. In other words, it is our job. If we're living under tyranny, it's our own fault.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're living under it, and it's our fault.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Because we're allowing them to do this. And that's why he says at the very bottom here that while Americans remain in their present enlightened condition and warmly attached to the cause of liberty, they cannot be enslaved. Should the general government become so lost to all sense of honor and freedom of the people as to attempt to enslave them, they who are the descendants of a race of men who have dethroned kings would make America Congress tremble, strip them of their public honors, and reduce them to the lowest state of degradation. Folks, that's what we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There we go.
Yeah, I've often thought, you know, you can compare all of the benefits that the government gives us or allows us to have. I often compare it to, you know, slaves fighting over which benefits their master will give them.
Yep. Because they've allowed them that power when we didn't have to do that.
And technically, instead of just, you know, fighting for their freedom, they're fighting over the benefits that their masters, which their master will give them, which is what we're doing.
Right. And all of it is... all of it...
Because that's what, you know, any legislative... You go to the state legislature, and they're all fighting over where money's going to go, who's going to get the money, and that's basically what they're doing, is they're fighting over, you know, they're a bunch of slaves fighting over what the master is going to allow them to give.
And none, I kept on trying to say all of it, but I think it's just easier to say none of the giving, government giving to the people, none of it is constitutional. They do not have the power to give us things.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they, you know, we said, hey, can you give us this? Yeah, we'll give you this and we'll give you that. And every time we ask them to give us something, it is at our own expense and at our own liberty, and that's how it's enslaved us. So, yeah. All right, so now we're going to jump down to the more recommended amendments. Now, above, I don't think we covered the recommended amendments earlier. Don't think we did. I think... John Hancock kind of suggested some, but we didn't go through all of them. But let's just say at this point in time, they're almost ready to ratify, because actually the next thing that's, you know, in the navigation pane is the analysis of the ratification by me. All I did was I went through and I identified how, you know, how if you sliced it this way, how did it ratify? Sliced it this way, how did it ratify? So let's look at these amendments. Go ahead.
Okay.
And we'll read them and we'll discuss them. Go ahead.
Okay. First, that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated by the aforesaid Constitution are reserved to the several states to be by them exercised.
Okay.
Secondly, that there shall be...
Hold on. Let's discuss that.
Okay.
So this amendment was thrown out as a recommendation. Was it adopted? That explicitly be declared that all powers not expressly delegated by the aforesaid Constitution reserved to the states. Is that was that adopted? Okay, so this was an amendment that changed and actually is what we call the 10th Amendment today. Okay? Okay, now what's the next one?
Secondly, that there shall be one representative to every 30,000 persons according to the census mentioned in the Constitution until the whole number of representatives amounts to 200.
Okay, then what? So what they had there is they had a partial amendment. So, okay, until it reaches this, but then what? What does it change to? They didn't include that. But actually, when you go into the very first amendment to the Constitution out of the Bill of Rights, it was the apportionment amendment that never got ratified, but it's never been incorporated because Connecticut didn't put its foot down and say, hey, we did ratify this. You need to inject this. Because what it would do is it would completely upset the Orcart or the Orcart. Because if the this amendment is ratified, it would force the apportionment to be to 50,000 persons. In other words, the state of Wyoming would instantly have, you know, 10, if not more, representatives in the House of Representatives. Because instead of Congress being able to limit the seats and therefore basically aggrandize, you know, the amount of people that they actually represent, which is completely unconscionable and unconstitutional. The fact is, here we go, that this would have maintained a more reasonable representation and would have forced the federal government to build a new House of Congress or to do something different. And today, I'm just saying that we could actually, you know, get the House of Representatives out of D.C. completely. And just same thing with the Senate. When you really think about it, because of near-time ruling, when we talk about the 17th Amendment and the state legislature is actually directly voting instead of these people being appointed, why have proxy when you can do it just as efficiently and effectively from the state house? Therefore, you know, the point is that this one amendment was actually in the Constitution. It was the very first one. It got ratified, but it's still problematic because Connecticut is refusing to put its foot down. And everybody is afraid if that actually was forced, it would just open up a whole can of worms. This is why it's being suppressed completely. So go ahead, let's do the third one.
Thirdly, that Congress do not exercise the power vested in them by the fourth section of the first article, that in cases where a state shall neglect or refuse to make the regulations therein mentioned, or shall make regulations subversive of the rights of the people to a free and equal representation in Congress agreeably to the Constitution.
So what that is the time, place, and manner of holding the elections shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. What they want to do is they want to eliminate, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulation. May, only if the state doesn't do it. So, in other words, I know they talked about this before, and this amendment didn't take. I think it was poorly argued by the Federalist for people to understand this, you know, what that really meant, what Section 4 of Article 1 really meant. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next one.
Fourthly, that Congress do not lay direct taxes, but when the money arising from the imposts and excise are insufficient for the public exigencies, nor then until Congress shall have first made a requisition upon the states to assess, levy, and pay their respective proportion of such requisitions agreeably to the census fixed in said Constitution, in such a way and manner as the legislature of the state shall think best. And in such case, if any state shall neglect or refuse to pay its proportion pursuant to such requisition, then Congress may assess and levy such state's proportion together with interest thereon, and at the rate of 6% per annum for the time of payment prescribed in such requisitions.
Okay, so they wanted to soften the ability to lay taxes. Now, what was this became one of the very first problems, and this, because I don't know if you remember the Assumption Act. We talked about the Assumption Act, and I think you, that was the beginning of you being on the show. Remember that?
I remember the wording, but I don't remember what it was.
Okay, so the Assumption Act was when the federal government decided, they moved forward, and they assumed the debt of each of the states. Because based on the Articles of Confederation, the states owed a certain amount of money, and that you know, the Continental Congress was just kind of like the, you know, the medium or the middleman in taking that debt and paying the other debts to the foreign nations and so forth. And so when we look at this, what they're trying to do here, that, oh, you got to use imposts and everything else, that you can't do this, they actually quickly moved into actually doing this because there were many states, and I'm not sure which ones that assumed, but actually it was a Ponzi scheme. This was the first Ponzi scheme brought up in the federal government, was the Assumption Act, which basically created the National Bank, which in the creation, they included the ability for the bank to create products. In other words, to sell bonds to, you know, people, Americans, to be able to buy bonds in the National Bank so that they could accrue interest. But that's how money would be infused into the bank, so that they would give them buying power to pay the debts and so forth. Anyway, long story short, this was one of those things that they wanted to help deal with the inability, or to basically make it hard for the federal government to actually get up front the money that they needed to function, by tying their hands and then saying, okay, if you then do, then you can come back and say, we really mean you need to give us this money. Anyway, so this didn't fly. It never went into any amendment. Fifthly, go ahead.
Fifthly, that Congress erects no company with exclusive advantages of commerce.
Okay. So, i.e., the National Bank creating banknotes or treasuries, or I should say, things, you know, products like bonds and those types of things. But that's exactly what they just did. Okay. Yeah. Sixthly,
that no person shall be tried for any crime by which he may incur an infamous punishment or loss of life until he be first indicted by a grand jury, except in such cases as may arise in the government and regulation of the land and naval forces.
Okay, so in other words, in cases of, you know, martial law, and that person is serving as a soldier, sailor, or what have you. So this actually went into the Fifth Amendment. So the Fifth Amendment basically says no person to be tried for any crime. I'm pretty sure it's the Fifth Amendment. And the Fifth Amendment says, yep, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentation or presentment of indictment of a grand jury. So, okay. Seventhly.
Okay. The Supreme Judicial Federal Court shall have no jurisdiction of causes between citizens of different states, unless the matter in dispute, whether it concern the reality or personality, be of the value of $3,000 at the least, nor shall the federal judicial powers extend any action between citizens of different states where the matter is in dispute, whether it concern the reality or personality, is not of the value of $1,500 at the least.
Okay, so as you can tell, we're kind of going into break here. And so in so doing, we need to take a pause as we go through this. But we will address the Supreme Court jurisdiction problem between citizens of different states and so forth when we come back. So we'll be right back after this, folks. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so we kind of covered this through the debate where they didn't like the idea that the federal court would be able to intervene. So what they tried to do is they tried to create a financial bar that it would require a certain amount of money. And I think that first value was $3,000 and then $1,500, you know, for the next one regarding realty. In other words, you know, land, property, that type of stuff. Or personality, and I think that's what it meant, personal properties. Anyway, all of that being said, this didn't take, but what ended up happening was instead of creating a tolerance to allow the federal courts some jurisdiction for appeals or what have you, what ended up happening was the 11th Amendment just said, you cannot get involved in these cases, period. And so that way, they severed, by the 11th Amendment, the ability for the Supreme Court to get involved into issues with private entities or persons that are, you know, citizens of another state or even foreign citizens. So anyway, as we kind of move forward into the next one, eighthly,
in civil actions between citizens of different states, every issue of fact arising in actions at common law shall be tried by a jury if the parties or either of them request it.
Okay, so this actually kind of gets incorporated into the 7th Amendment. And then ninthly,
Congress shall at no time consent that any person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall accept a title of nobility or any other title or office from any king, prince, or foreign state.
So this didn't actually make it in the Bill of Rights, but this was the 13th Amendment that was ratified in 1812. This actually was even more so because it wasn't just that they couldn't be in office. If a person accepted a title of nobility or that type of emolument or anything from a king, potent, or so forth, that they would lose their citizenship unless Congress allowed it. And so that 13th Amendment really tied everybody's hands, and it made it impossible for members of the bar to actually be citizens of the United States. Which is, as you understand, when the bar actually was finally established in the 1870s, that 13th Amendment was a huge problem, and they had to get rid of it. So instead of repealing it, they just expunged it. That is, you know, that goes to show the power of the bar and our legal system when they put their mind to actually getting rid of the law itself and, you know, expunging something, unconstitutionally doing all of this. Folks, I mean, I hope you understand the ramifications of that 13th Amendment and why they had to get rid of it, and they successfully did because nobody even recognizes that 13th Amendment is ratified anymore. They tried to cover all of their bases, but we have empirical data that proves it was ratified because it was in the compiled laws of Wyoming in 1871. Same thing in Colorado and other states. It was documented that that was an actual amendment to the Constitution that was in force. So look at what they did. Anyway, okay. So on the analysis, because when you kind of just go to that level, I identify the different counties, right? But 1, 2, 3, because these are the counties of ratification. So as you look at the numbers out of the counties, there were 8 counties to 5 counties that ratified. So in other words, that was a significant 62% ratification. When you go by popular vote, it was 53%. So either way, the Constitution was ratified. But we really don't know how they, you know, because I don't think they put in the final numbers of how it was other than it was. And so, and actually they put the total nays and so forth. Again, I just don't know. But the what I want to show you folks and what you should see, Tammy, is if you actually make it so that the counties, a majority of the counties, or a threshold of the counties, like 2/3, I would think a majority of the counties, because in Wyoming, how many counties are problematic? 2, 3, 4?
Yeah.
Maybe 4?
Yep.
Out of what, 20-some counties?
23.
So in other words, the day that you guys would be coming close to 50-50 on ratifying a law, ratifying an amendment to the Constitution, would probably be, you know, a long ways away to getting to that point of polarity, right, where you're that close to tipping one way or the other. So in other words, why wouldn't the state require the ratification of the amendment to the Constitution to require at least a majority of the counties, not by popular vote? See my point? Because they would never, the progressives would never be in the position that they are today, folks. Period. If every state constitution had these checks and balances to kept democracies and popular vote from actually being able to undermine them, wow, I mean, we wouldn't be in this situation today in America, period. Other than the fact that the Supreme Court and the courts and the jurists have aggrandized themselves to reinterpret and to basically move judicial activism into force to basically change, actively change our government and what it really meant and so forth. So anyway, I wanted to just do this in this particular case because it was pretty transparent how they voted as counties and so forth. And they actually counted, you know, who voted yay, nay, and so forth. And so that's why when you go through some of the names, you go, wow, that's pretty impressive. But anyway, all that being said, okay, so we've wrapped up Massachusetts. And now we're going to dive into South Carolina. Okay?
All right.
So, moment of silence. Okay, all done. All right. So, it was just a moment. I wasn't saying a minute or anything. But anywho, the first thing that I highlight is Honorable Charles Pinckney, and they talk about the Articles of Confederation. And so, this right here, because I believe, if I remember correctly, Charles Pinckney was in the Constitutional Convention, right?
Yes.
Yes, he was. Okay. There were the two Pinckneys, right? General Pinckney and Charles. So this is a long one, so let's go ahead and dive into the pool here. Let's go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. It must be recollected that upon the conclusion of the definitive treaty, great inconveniences were experienced as resulting from the inefficiency of the Confederation. The one first and most sensibly felt was the destruction of our commerce, occasioned by the restrictions of other nations, whose policy it was not in the power of the general government to counteract. The loss of credit, the inability in our citizens to pay taxes, and languor of government were, as they ever must be, the certain consequences of the decay of commerce. Frequent and unsuccessful attempts were made by Congress to obtain the necessary powers. The states, too, individually attempted by navigation acts and other commercial provisions to remedy the evil. These, instead of correcting, served but to increase it. Their regulations interfered not only with each other, but in almost every instance with treaties existing under the authority of the Union. Hence arose the necessity of some general and permanent system which should at once embrace all interests, and by placing the state upon firm and united ground, enable them effectually to assert their commercial rights. Sensible that nothing but a concert of measures could effect this, Virginia proposed a meeting of commissioners at Annapolis from the legislature of each state, who should be empowered to take into consideration the commerce of the Union, to consider how far a uniform system in their commercial regulations might be necessary to their common interest, and to report to the states such an act as, when unanimously ratified by them, would enable Congress effectually to provide for the same. In consequence of this, 10 states appointed delegates. By accident or otherwise, they did not attend, only 5 states being represented. The gentlemen present, not being a majority of the Union, did not conceive it advisable to proceed. But in an address to their constituents, which was also transmitted to other legislatures, acquainted them with the circumstances of their meeting, that there appeared to them to be other and more material defects in the federal system than merely those of commercial powers.
Okay, so you can pause right there. That's fine. So
okay.
What we're looking at is literally a summation of what was happening. So he starts off with this grand treaty, right? The conclusion of the definitive treaty, that definitive treaty being the treaty that ended the treaty with Britain. And so he talks about all of these different problems under the Union and how, in commercial essence, they were really just, they were struggling. Everybody was struggling. And so there was this call at Annapolis where each of the states would be empowered to go and talk about commerce. And in consequence of this, 10 states appointed delegates, by accident or otherwise, did not attend, only 5 states being represented. In other words, only half of the states that empowered their delegates to go, only half of them showed up. And so that was the initial Annapolis meeting that they were going to have, and I think it was early 86, and then in September 86, they met again in Annapolis, and these 5 states, and this is when Madison and Alexander Hamilton were together. There was one time in this first meeting of the states to deal with these problems of the Confederation. And this is when they actually decided, or they all concluded, that there are far more deficiencies and defects in the Articles of Confederation that needed to be affixed, that they needed to actually do something. And so they created, and we covered all of this earlier this year when we went through the Articles of Association, then we went through the Articles of Confederation, we went through those commissions. Remember, we read all of these things earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
So we covered all this history. He's recapping that to get us to the point of the convention and then the ratification. So pick it back up where you were. Go ahead.
Okay. That these, upon examination, might be found greater than even the acts of their appointments implied, was at least so far probable from the embarrassments which mark the present state of national affairs, foreign and domestic, as to merit in their opinions a deliberate and candid discussion in some mode which would unite the sentiments and counsels of all the states. They therefore suggested the appointment of another convention under more extensive powers for the purpose of devising such further provisions as should appear to them necessary to render the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the Union.
Okay, so you know why he's doing this, by the way. Because South Carolina, just like Virginia, just like all of the other states that actually had a vigorous debate, there were 6 of them, these 6 states contended that what happened at that convention was illegitimate, that these men did not have the proper authority to do what they did. We covered this during the convention because they talked about their commission and how every time they brought up their commission, they made sure that what they were doing was meeting the exigencies of the Union. So this is where they're basically creating the argument that, hey, we can't go forward because this is not a legitimate document. We shouldn't accept this as a legitimate. So this is basically Charles Pickney recapping everything to say what we did was legitimate, because that's what he's ultimately going to conclude here. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay, under this recommendation, the late convention assembled for most of the appointments had been made before the recommendation of Congress was formed or known. He thought proper concisely to mention the manner of the convention's assembling merely to obviate an objection which all the opposers of the federal system had used, that at the time the convention met, no opinion was entertained of their departing from the Confederation, right, that merely the grant of commercial powers and the establishment of federal revenue were in agitation, whereas nothing can be more true than that its promoters had for their object a firm national government. Those who had seriously contemplated this subject were fully convinced that a total change of system was necessary, that however the repair of the Confederation might for a time avert the inconveniences of a dissolution, it was impossible a government of that sort could long unite this growing and extensive country. They also thought that the public mind was fully prepared for the change, and that no time could be more proper for introducing it than the present, that the total want of government, the destruction of commerce, the public credit, private confidence, and national character were surely sufficiently alarming to awaken their constituents to a true sense of their situation.
Right. At the very beginning of this, he points out that he basically stated that these people who were against the convention were assembling merely to obviate, to remove the, you know, this, I rephrase this. Here he's basically saying that what he's trying to do is to remove the objection of the opposers of this new federal system, vis-a-vis what is coming out of the Constitutional Convention, this Constitution that they're presenting. So basically, because I know Pauline Mayer, the struggle for the ratification of the Constitution covered this detail. Most of the states did not capture these debates or this part where they were actually arguing for convening the ratification, because the anti-federal said, hey, we're not even going to swear in. We're not moving forward. We believe that this. So they created a debate before the debate. And so most of the states did not record that. They only recorded the actual ratification process because that's why they were there. Okay, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I lost where I was at.
Yeah, under this momentous impression, yep.
Oh, okay, down a little further. Under this momentous impressions, the convention met when the first question that naturally presented itself to the view of almost every member, although it was never formally brought forward, was the formation of a new or the amendment of the existing system. Whatever might have been the opinions of a few speculative men who either did or pretended to confide more in the virtue of the people than prudence warranted, Mr. Pickney said he would venture to assert that the states were unanimous in preferring a change. They wisely considered that, though the Confederation might possess the great outlines of a general government, yet that it was, in fact, nothing more than a federal union, or, strictly speaking, a league founded in paternal and persuasive principles with nothing permanent and coercive in its construction, where the members might or might not comply with their federal engagements as they thought proper, that no power existed of raising supplies but by the requisitions or quotas on the states, that this defect had been almost fatally evinced by the experience of the states for the last 6 or 8 years, in which not one of them had completely complied, but a few had even paid up their specie portions, others very partially, and some, he had every reason to believe, had not to this day contributed a shilling to the common treasury since the Union was formed. He should not go into a detail of the conduct of the states or the unfortunate and embarrassing situation to which their inattention has reduced the Union. These have been so often and so strongly represented by Congress that he was sure there could not be a member on the floor unacquainted with them. It was sufficient to remark that the convention saw and felt the necessity of establishing a government upon different principles, which instead of requiring the intervention of 13 different legislatures between the demand and the complaint, should operate upon the people in the first instance.
Okay, keep going. I think this is all really good as far as helping everybody understand the what a struggle it was with the anti-federalists trying to reject, you know, the commissions of what these men really were commissioned to do. Go ahead.
He repeated that the necessity of having a government which should at once operate upon the people and not upon the states was conceived to be indispensable by every delegation present. That, however, they may have differed with respect to the quantum of power, no objection was made to the system itself. He considered it, however, highly necessary that in the establishment of a constitution possessing extensive natural authorities, a proper distribution of its power should be attended to. Sensible of the danger of a single body, and that to such a council the states ought not to entrust important rights, they considered it their duty to divide the legislature into two branches, and by a limited revisionary power to mingle in some degree their executive in their proceedings, a provision that he was pleased to find meets with universal approbation. The degree of weight which each state was to have in the federal council became a question of much agitation. The larger states contended that no government could long exist whose principles were founded in injustice, that one of the most serious and unanswerable objections to the present system was the injustice of its tendency in allowing each state an equal vote, notwithstanding their striking disparity. The small ones replied, and perhaps with reason, that as the states were the pillars upon which the general government must ever rest, their state governments must remain, that however they may vary in point of territory or population, as political associations they were equal, that upon these terms they formally confederated, and that no inducement whatsoever should tempt them to unite upon others, that if they did, it would amount to nothing less than throwing the whole government of the Union into the hands of three or four of the largest states. Yes, it would.
Okay, so no. So that right there is very powerful, because we knew that the southern or the small states demanded this equal representation. And mm-hmm. So this is why the 17th Amendment guaranteed that equal suffrage in the Senate would be preserved. Okay, so go ahead.
Right. After much anxious discussion, for had the convention separated without determining upon a plan, it would have been on this point, a compromise was effected by which it was determined that the first branch be so chosen as to represent in due proportion the people of the Union, that the Senate should be the representatives of the state, where each should have an equal weight. Though he was at first opposed to this compromise, yet he was far from thinking it an injudicious one. The different branches of the legislature being intended as checks upon each other, it appeared to him they would more effectually restrain their mutual intemperances under this mode of representation than they would have done if both houses had been so formed upon proportionable principles. Mm-hmm. For let us theorize as much as we will, it will be impossible so far to divest the majority of the federal representatives of their state views and policy as to induce them always to act upon truly national principles. Men do not easily wean themselves of those preferences and attachments which country and connections invariably create, and it must frequently have happened, had the larger states acquired that decided majority which a proportionable representation would have given them in both houses, that state views the policy would have influenced their deliberations. The ease with which they would, upon all occasions, have secured a majority in the legislature might, in times less virtuous, than the present have operated as temptations to designing and ambitious men to sacrifice the public good to private views. This cannot be the case at present. The different mode of representation for the Senate will, as has already been observed, most effectually prevent it. The purpose of establishing different houses of legislation was to introduce the influence of different interests and principles, and he thought that we should derive from this mode of separating the legislature into two branches those benefits which a proper complication of principles is capable of producing, and which must, in his judgment, be greater than any evils that may arise from their temporary dissensions.
Okay, so that's another key point here, the purpose of creating bicameral legislative bodies to separate the interests of the people and the states so that those legislative bodies would be able to tend to their constituents specifically, not to compete amongst each other for control. So, brilliant stuff. Keep going. As a matter of fact, we got 2 minutes, so if you can do this last paragraph, good.
Okay. The judicial he conceived to be at once the most important and intricate part of the system. That a supreme federal jurisdiction was indispensable cannot be denied. It is equally true that in order to ensure the administration of justice, it was necessary to give it all the powers original as well as appellate. The Constitution has enumerated, without it, we could not expect a due observance of treaties. That the state judiciary would confine themselves with their proper sphere, or that general sense of justice pervade the Union, which this part of the Constitution is intended to introduce and protect. That much, however, would depend upon the wisdom of the legislatures who are to organize it. That from the extensiveness of its powers, it may be easily seen that under a wise management, this department might be made the keystone of the arch, the means of connecting and bridging the whole together, of preserving uniformity in all the judicial proceedings of the Union. That in republics, much more in time of peace, would always depend upon the energy and integrity of the judicial than on any part of the government. That to ensure these extensive authorities were necessary, particularly so were they in a tribunal constituted as this, whose duty it would be not only to decide all national questions which should arise within the Union, but to control and keep the state judicials within their proper limits whenever they shall attempt to interfere with its power.
Excellent job. Okay, so he's, again, there's some really key things that have come out in this. And so to explain the whole purpose of the bicameral legislative bodies, this right here is one of the first debates that really did a good job of that, where, and it also kind of put more of a focus so that we could actually see the struggle that they had to just open up the debates, where the anti-federalists were saying, oh, we're going to leave because this is not right. And so they actually had to decide in each of these states on their own whether it was legitimate to actually debate the Constitution, and the majority of, in each case, decided forward to do it. So with that, they went into these debates because everybody felt, the majority of the people felt, that the commissions were not violated. The question was answered a long time ago that the commissions were not violated. But yet today, we keep on hearing that, you know, oh, it was, and it just makes me, infuriates me. I'm J.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.